All right, so recently, last week, I guess, I mentioned to you, those of you who were here, that I started building a chicken coop at our house, but I forgot to, left out the best part, which is what Johnny calls the chicken coop. So she thinks it's called a chicken poop. So that's pretty funny and pretty cute. I don't know where she came up with that. She came up with it all on her own. But she loves to hang out with Daddy while he's working on the chicken poop. But what I've realized through this process is, well, one, I'm not a builder. I think I knew that before. Chris gave me a hand the other day a little bit, and now he knows the same thing. That's why you laughed, I'm sure. But what I realized is that it's a process, right? And that just like life, building the chicken coop is about progress, not perfection. Or at least that's what I've told myself, yeah. So the thing is, though, as I've reflected on the chicken coop process and related that to my faith and just what it means to follow Jesus, I've realized that a lot of times we forget about the process and we just think about the end destination, right? We think about our faith as something that once we say yes to Jesus, once we put our faith in him, then we only think about the destination, which is heaven, which is true, right? There's truth in that. But we forget about that whole space in between of this life where we are called to walk with Jesus and to walk down this path. And Jesus calls it a path. He calls it a road. He calls it a narrow road. In Matthew 7:13-14, he says this. We read this last week. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way — that word way is literally a road or a path — the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow, and the way, or the road, is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. And so Jesus says there's a way of life. There is a lifestyle, a road that we can walk down, one that will lead us to destruction, and another one, and that one is wide. That's the easy way. That's the way that most people go because it's easy. Or there's a way that's narrow, a way that's hard, that leads to life. And that is the way of God. That is the path of God. The narrow path of following Jesus is a way. It is a road. And last week we kind of looked at, okay, you can really look at the whole Bible through this lens of being like a journey or a road. You think about the people of Israel and how they had a journey to go through, right? So the people of Israel, they started out in Egypt. That was the place of slavery. Then God rescued them at the Red Sea. He split the waters for them to cross over on dry ground. He led them through the wilderness, this place of healing, this place where they learned to listen and were supposed to learn to listen and trust him. And then led them to the promised land, this place of freedom. And there's this path. There was this road that God led them down. The narrow path, the theme of the narrow path through the Bible, is one that leads people out of slavery, through the wilderness, and into freedom. Okay, and this is what God is still doing in the world today with us. He wants us to walk this narrow path, as you see in the gray up there. He wants us to walk from the place where we are in unbelief, where we don't believe and trust in him, to the place of faith, where we put our faith or we put our trust in him. Then through discipleship, which is trusting, walking that out, following him. It's like walking that wilderness path. And finally, we will make it to the place of transformation, to the place where we become fully transformed and like Christ. And so that's this path that you can follow throughout. And this theme is throughout the whole Bible. And it really starts in Genesis. And so we're going to look at, if you have a Bible with you, I encourage you to open it up to Genesis chapter 3. And we are going to look at how this path kind of gets started, and the narrow path versus the wide path. Okay, so turn to Genesis chapter 3. So if you're familiar with the Bible, you know Genesis chapter 1, God created man and woman, creates them in his image on the sixth day of creation. He says that they are good. Okay, Genesis 1:31, here's the line that God gives after he creates humans. He says, God saw that everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. Okay? One of the really interesting things about Genesis chapter 1 is that every time God created something, at the end of that day, he said it was good. Like, he creates the land, he creates the sea, he creates the animals. It's good, it's good, it's good. When he creates humans on the sixth day, he says, and it was very good. That word for very means exceedingly or abundantly. God says when he creates humans, they were exceedingly good. Very good. But then Genesis chapter 2, you read more detail of how he created the humans. And he talks about how he made Eve from Adam's rib and all those things. And then in verse 2:25 says this line, which is really important today. Genesis 2:25, the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. And so that might feel a little strange to us for them to say that, right? Like, why would they point that out? But this is very significant, because if you think about what being naked is like you're exposed, right? You're exposed, you're vulnerable, right? And so what this means is that they were vulnerable to not only one another, but God. Like, God could see all of them, each other, they could see all of them, they had nothing to hide. There's a vulnerability that came with them. But here's the amazing part, they were naked, but they felt no shame. They were vulnerable, they could see everything about one another, but they didn't feel shame about it. And this isn't just thrown in there like at the end of Genesis chapter 2 for no reason. Like, God could have said, think about what all the other ways God could have described how they felt at that moment. He could have said they were naked and they felt happy. They were at peace. There was no anger. They didn't feel fear. He didn't say any of those things. He said they were naked and they felt no shame. They were unashamed. And so if the story ended here in Genesis chapter 2, number one, it might be awkward because human beings might all still be running around naked, and that would be super awkward right now, right? But it didn't end there, okay? It didn't end there. So Genesis chapter 3, go ahead and turn to that if you're there by now. We're going to read in chapter 3, starting in verse 1. It says this, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of the tree in the garden?'" So we see that there's this serpent here who is representing Satan. This is the adversary of humans. He is the spiritual enemy, and he's crafty. He knows how to beat and defeat humans. He would love to see humans rebel against God and suffer the same fate as him, which is destruction. And so currently in the story, in the long line of the story, there's only one way for them to rebel against God, because there's only one rule. Genesis chapter 2, just to go back a little bit, this was the rule that God gave to Adam. He said, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." And so this was the one rule that God had given them. And now you think about how many trees were probably in that garden. Like, we don't know how big the garden was, but there was probably tons of trees, right? Maybe thousands of trees. And God said, "You can eat from any of these trees, but there's one tree that you're not allowed to eat from, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." And what that represented was the authority to determine what is good and what is evil. That's what eating from that tree represented. And so God was saying, only I am able to have the authority to say what's good and what's wrong and what is good and what is evil. And so he's saying, don't try to take that authority for yourself. All these other trees, I created all these things. You can have any of them, just not the tree of good and evil. And so to eat from this tree would mean to kind of take yourself, your situation into your own hands and to say, I'm going to be my own God. I'm not going to let God be God. And that would lead you to death. And so here's why the serpent is so crafty, though, right? He doesn't just come up to the humans. Think about where we're at in the story, right? There's one rule that God has. He doesn't just come up to the humans and say, "Hey, take a bite from that tree." Like, wouldn't that be do the thing that God told you not to do? Like, just make a bad choice. He doesn't come up and do that. Okay, what he does is he casts doubt in their minds first. And he creates a rift between them and God first. He wants to disconnect them from God and to disconnect them from one another through these subtle lies. Okay, look what he says in verse 2 and 3 when he does this. He said to the woman, "Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?" Right, that's verse 1 again. But think about that. Like, what is he doing there? He's casting doubt on what God had said. He wants Eve to doubt that God tells the truth. He wants to create the separation between her and her creator. And so that's actually not what God said. God said you could eat from any tree in the garden except one. He didn't ever say that. So this is a very subtle lie. And then we see the woman's reply in verses 2 and 3. And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the tree of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Okay, so the woman's reply is kind of a half truth, because God never actually said anything about touching the tree. She kind of added that in, right? And so this is the lies are getting more subtle and further down. We're getting further and further from the truth, and then ultimately, Satan's going to throw this in there in verse 4. The serpent said to the woman, "You will surely not die." Okay, flat out lie. God told her she would die if she ate it. God told them. And so he says, you will not die, for God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So he just flat out lies, right? He says to her, "Hey, you're not going to die. God just doesn't want you to have this good thing. God doesn't want you to know good and evil like he can." And so what the serpent is doing, one of the things he's doing, right, he's creating this rift between her and God, but he's also wanting Eve to feel her inadequacy. Like he's wanting Eve to feel like she as a human is not enough. Like it is not enough to just be human. You have to be something more than human. And what he's introducing to her is shame. Okay, sorry. Kurt Thompson writes about this verse and says this, and I think he's right. He says, "The serpent uses subtle lies and deception to introduce shame. Shame because all of a sudden she questions her relationship with God. She questions if being human is good enough. She questions if there's something better." Right, I think that is what's the underlying, that it doesn't say that, and so we're kind of speculating a little bit, but I think it's fair to speculate. This is what Satan's goal is, to make her question herself, to realize that she is inadequate. And so, yes, of course, the fruit would taste good to Eve, but the inner state that's driving the temptation to take the fruit isn't how the taste would be. It is, maybe I'm not good enough how I am. Maybe I need to grab that fruit and to become like God. She's aware of her perceived inadequacy. And so we read in verse 6, here's what she does. Because she is aware of that, she tries to do something to cover that up. Verse 6, it says, "When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate." Okay, so she takes the fruit. She breaks the one rule. Okay, and remember, the introduction of shame is what led her to break that one rule. The relationship was distorted, and then sin comes into the world. And along with sin coming into the world, at that moment, the thing that's underlying almost every sin is this question of shame. It's lurking behind almost every sin and evil in the world, is this perceived inadequacy of human beings. And so sin entered the world in Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, and along with it came shame. So what is shame? This is what we're looking at today. This is our topic and what's coming out of Genesis chapter 2 and 3. So first of all, we have to understand about shame is that it is a experienced emotion, right? It's a felt emotion. It's an emotion that even like dogs can experience it, right? Like you think about the cone of shame, like they know when they feel shame. And so it's an emotion that all of us can feel at certain times. And the emotion shame isn't necessarily bad in itself, okay? There's such a thing as healthy shame and there's such a thing as toxic shame. So healthy shame is to say, I am a human being, okay? I have limitations and I have weaknesses and my actions affect other people. That's a healthy view of shame. Like I have limitations. I want my kids to feel healthy shame. Like when my 2-year-old daughter like walks up to somebody and smacks them in the face, like I don't want her to feel good about that, right? Which just happens, right? It's happened this week, I'm sure. Like I don't want her to feel good about that. She should feel a little bit of shame when she does that, right? Like John, like you can't do that, right? And all of us need that in our life. Like when we do something that harms somebody else, we should feel a healthy shame about that. Healthy shame keeps us grounded, makes us realize we are not God, right? It's called humility, is really another way to say that. And all relationships require a little bit of healthy shame. But here's the thing. When our weaknesses and our limitations become our identity and become infused with our identity, okay, that is when it becomes toxic shame. Let me try to give you a little illustration of how that works. And so this week we went to the grocery store. It was actually last Sunday night, and it was late, and we got home really late from getting the groceries. And it was my job to put the groceries away, and I failed. And she said just to do the cold stuff because we'll do the other stuff in the morning. So I failed to get all the cold stuff. Long story short, I failed to get all the cold stuff in the fridge. And so I wasted probably like $30 worth of meat. And so I was beating myself up for that. I was like, man, that was stupid. But then in my mind, like I could tell where my mind was going with it, was like, not only was that stupid, but you're stupid. Like that was a mistake, but you make mistakes all the time like this. Like you're not responsible. You're a bad leader. Like good leaders don't do stuff like that. And so the shame, the healthy shame was I made a mistake. I have a weakness, right? I shouldn't have done that. I should have got the food in the right place. Toxic shame begins to infuse that mistake with my identity and say, I'm a bad person. I am not good enough. I am a failure. And that is what toxic shame is at its core. Okay, at its core, toxic shame is the belief that you are worthless, that we are worthless. That's the belief that to be human isn't good, that I have to be more. I have to become like God. And so when we feel toxic shame, when we become people who are bound by toxic shame, everything that we experience begins to be affected by that shame, right? Even a little thing like forgetting to put the groceries away or wasting, right? That becomes shame-bound experience. That becomes an experience where I feel like I am no good or worthless. I think toxic shame is the emotion of hell, right? None of us like to feel that feeling. It is the emotion that hell uses against us more than any other emotion. And it's the belief that we are ultimately worthless. And so that's what toxic shame is. It's this belief that we are at our core worthless. And so where does shame come from? Okay, where does shame come from? So first of all, we all can get some shame from families, okay, from the family that we grow up in. And no family is perfect, and all families are going to have some level of shame. But the saying, you might have heard the saying, hurt people, right? The same thing is true with shame. Shamed people shame people. And so some people who are very shamed in their life don't know anything else to do but to shame others. And if you think about it, if people don't know how to value themselves properly, then how could they teach somebody else to value themselves? And so it makes sense that we see family as a place where we have a lot of shame, right? And so here's some hallmarks, I guess you could say, of a shame-based family. We'll quickly just go through some of these. So lawlessness, like a place where there's no rules, there's no consequences for behavior, that is a hallmark of a shame-based family. But then also perfectionism, right? So like on the one side, you've got no rules. On the other side, you've got perfectionism, and everything has to be perfect all the time, and you can't have an honest conversation about mistakes or anything like that. Right? That is also shame-based, okay? Either side of those things. Another one is overbearing criticism, okay? I know some of us, we might have grown up in a place where in a family where there was overbearing criticism, right? There was constant criticism. Okay, that is a shame-based experience. Also, on the other side of it then, is there's no room for constructive criticism. Sometimes families we avoid criticism altogether because it makes us feel shame, and there can't be like good criticism, constructive criticism, because we're so shame-bound that there's no place for that. Another one that sometimes happens, and we're just kind of quickly going over these. We're not diving too deep into them, but codependent parenting. This is when the parents have their emotional needs met by the kids, right? Parents aren't able to meet their own emotional needs, and so they depend on their kids to meet their emotional needs. Like a quick example of that would be like if I'm having a bad day, and I like make it like my emotions are tied to like how good my kids are doing, for maybe in sports or something like that. Like, if my kids are doing really well, then I'm having a good day. If they're doing bad, then I'm having a bad day. So parents can't do that, right? These are all, and then the last one is abuse, right? Obviously, physical abuse, sexual abuse, all those things. There's probably don't need to go into it in detail. You realize that shame comes from our families of origin at some level. Okay, on another level, and I want to talk a little bit more about this because this is where we're at, right? Shame can come from our church or our church family or our religious background. There's a theology out there, right, around human beings that we are just worthless sinners. I've probably believed that a lot in my life, probably even taught that sometimes, as Heidi smiles at me. Here's the thing. Are you a sinner? Yes. Are you worthless? No. Okay? We are not worthless sinners. We are sinners with worth. And there's a difference with that, right? There's this theology out there that yeah, I've probably believed and probably even taught at times, honestly, that just says you're nothing, right? You're just a worm. Nothing that you can do is of any value. Everything that you do is sin, right? So like if I walked out the door and I helped an old lady across the street right now, like you probably just did that for like getting the praise, right? You wicked person. You just did that so others would see it. Like you can't do anything good. Everything's tainted with sin. And so in shaming churches, here's some of the things that happen. That's the worthless sinner theology. Also, we always question in our motivations. People question motivations in shaming churches. Like I just said, when somebody does something good, people are always wondering, like, I wonder why they really did that, right? There's probably some motive that they had that wasn't good. Okay, that's a sign of a shame-based church. Here's another one, right? We shame-based churches, they focus on should news instead of good news. And here's what I mean by that, right? The good news is the gospel. We should focus on the good news of the gospel, that although we are sinners, God loved us. He sent Jesus to die for our sins, and that we can have a relationship with him. But should news is you should do this. You should be more like. You should not do this. This is the right way too. Here's how you should talk in church. Here's how you should dress in church. Here's how you should behave in almost every situation. Now, I'm not saying that we can't talk about those things, that there might be some best practices there, but the should news churches focus only on external compliance to the rules, okay, which many times are actually man-made rules that we're talking about here. They're religious in nature, but they're not really from God. That's what should news churches do. I'll give you a quick example of that. When I was growing up, the church that I was part of, we were taught to take communion in third grade, okay, and so I don't really remember a lot from third grade, so I might be off a little bit here, but my third grade brain basically remembers from learning how to take communion that 90% of what we learned about it was how you should look while you're taking it. Like, here's how to hold your hands, here's how to walk down the aisle, right, here's where they're going to put it, here's what you do after. And I learned all that, like, they were very strict on that, right, but as far as, like, what communion actually meant, and why I was taking communion and what all that was, I mean, I don't really remember learning much about that. And maybe it's just because I was in third grade. But that's just an example, right? It's when churches are all about like the external things, like what it looks like. And here's the last one. Okay, when the Bible doubles as a hammer, right? Colton, I bet you didn't know that I could just use this, just use it as a hammer too, right? So here's the thing. Sometimes we try to make the Bible also be used as a hammer. And here's what I want to say about this. So this is our last part about the church's thing. We don't shy away from the Bible, okay, especially here or anywhere. Like, we should never shy away from the Bible. And there are hard things in the Bible. There's verses in the Bible that should, when we read them, they should almost hit us like a hammer, like, just because that is the truth of the Bible. Like, so I'm not saying here we shy away from the truth. But there's a difference between shying away from the truth and then purposefully using the Bible to beat others down with it, right? And especially doing that out of a judgmental heart. This happens way too much in churches, okay? Churches wrongly think that if somebody just feels bad about themselves enough, that will be enough to get them to change their behavior. It's not true, okay? It never lasts. You might be able to change somebody's behavior by getting them to feel bad about themselves for a little bit, but that does not last long term and give life change. And so these are just some signs of what a shame-based church looks like. So we get shame from our families. We get shame sometimes from churches. But I missed putting it on there what maybe the most important one is, and that's ourself. Okay? We can't just be the victim in this. So yes, we get it from other places, but we also put shame on ourselves. And ultimately, our responsibility is, like, it comes down to, it's our responsibility to not believe shame. Okay, just like Eve had a choice, right? She had a choice, and Adam had a choice to listen to who he was going to listen to who they were going to listen to. Am I going to listen to the voice of the serpent, or am I going to remember what the voice of God said? Right? We have that same choice. Are we going to listen? Who are we going to listen to? Are we going to allow ourselves to believe this story that says I'm worthless and no good, or am I going to believe what God says about me? We have a choice in it. We have responsibility in it. We can decide what we're going to do when we begin to feel shame and whether we're going to allow that to become a core belief or not. And so what we have to do then is become more aware of the shame. We have to become able to notice and name it. And here, I'm going to pass these out. I forgot to pass them out earlier. Colton, can you pass this out for me? Yep. So these are coming around. I know they are... I know there's a lot of words on here, okay? So don't get scared away by all the words. This is something that we're going to use over a long period of time to help us walk this narrow path with Jesus. But I want to point us to the bottom left, once you get your paper, the basement or the place of shame. So on this paper, you've got the inside. This is the narrow way. The very inside part is where we want to be as Christians. We want to be in the place of freedom. We want to be in the place where God is changing us and transforming us from the inside out. That's where we want to be, okay? And to walk through that place, we have to walk this narrow road of healing. But where we often find ourselves, too often, is on the outside, following this cycle of the wide path, the way that the world usually goes. And the cycle starts in the bottom left-hand corner, the basement or the place of shame. And so this is what we've been talking about. And what we have to do is to be able to realize this is where I'm at. And one of the ways we do that is by just naming the emotion of shame, saying, I feel shame right now, or I'm thinking, I'm having some false thinking about myself. I'm thinking things like I'm not worthy. I'm too messed up. God's given up on me. Okay, those are false thinking. Those are signs of shame. And we have to be able to realize I'm in this place, okay? Before you can fix it or do anything about it, you just got to know, hey, I'm thinking down this cycle of shame and I'm living my life in this place of the basement. And so we have to notice it first. That's why our emotions are important as Christians, okay? Because it's not that we listen to our emotions. It's not that we give into our emotions and just do what we feel like doing based off our emotions, but we need to know what our emotions are so that I can know what to do with them, so that I can know what God wants me to do with them, so I can bring them to him, and that I don't walk down the wide path with my emotions and let it lead me to the next place, but I walk the narrow path with God. And so we have to become self-aware of where we're at, and we do that by practicing noticing where I'm at, what my emotions are, and knowing where I'm at on that, where I'm tempted to be on that outer circle, so that I can head towards the middle of the circle. And so where does shame lead us, right? As we think about that, where does shame lead us? Looking back at Genesis 3, if you're still open to that, this is the last verse we'll look at today. Genesis 3, 7 and 8. What did it lead Adam and Eve to do? It says, then, after they sinned, then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. They sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. And then they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid among themselves and from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. So what did they do? They covered themselves first. They didn't want anyone else to see in. And then they literally hide. Okay, they try to hide from God. And you think about how silly that is, but that is the natural response to shame. When we feel shame, we want to hide. And listen, we do the same thing. We do the same thing. When we feel shame, we want to hide from others. We want to hide from our family. We want to hide from our church. We want to hide from our spouse. We want to hide from our neighbors. We do the same types of things because we feel shame. We feel worthless. We feel bad about who we are. And what we end up doing, if we live in that long enough, is we create a false self. We hide from real relationships. We create an image of what other we want others to see in us. Like if I feel bad about who I am as a in my core, what I'm going to do naturally is try to be somebody else. I'm going to live as a false self. And that is the wide path, okay? If I find myself in the bottom left-hand corner, this place of shame, and I just follow the way of the world, the wide path, the easy next step, I'm going to hide. I'm going to live as a false self. I'm going to internalize the shame. I'm going to believe that the real me is worthless, and I'm going to go into hiding, and I'm going to live as a false self. Ultimately, this is the path of hiding from God and hiding from others. And so I just want to ask you this question today as we close here. Are you living in that path or that place? Are you living your life in the bottom left-hand corner, in the basement, in the place of shame, and believing that you are worthless? In believing that you are essentially just a worthless sinner. Okay, is that where you're at right now? Ask yourself that question as we sit here and think and reflect on that question. Now, next week, we're going to get to the answer. Okay, this week, I just want us to sit in it for a minute. Okay, this is where the problems start. And you're going to notice as we go through this whole thing, we're going to go from hiding the place of shame to hiding the place of loneliness. And then that leads us to sometimes want to focus on achievement. And then we chase after these achievements and then we still feel bad. And so we give into temptation and then it leads us back to despair and back to shame. And there's this huge cycle. Okay. But the cycle starts when we believe this lie that we are essentially worthless and no good. But we're going to get to the answer next week. But I just want to kind of hit that just a little bit so we're not completely just here with no answers. The answer, guys, to toxic shame is to know that we are valued from God. Okay, this is the only answer to our toxic shame, is to recognize and realize that we do have value from God. Yes, we are sinners. Okay, yes, we will sin. We will make mistakes. But God actually truly does value us. He truly does love us. He truly does love you, not just because he has to, because he's God, but because he actually does. And even as you battle sin in this world, you have to realize that believing this, okay, like actually believing this, that God values you, is the first step to freedom from sin. Remember back to the story, right? In Genesis 3, remember how God doesn't just come up to the humans and say, hey, like make a bad choice. Do something that's wrong. He doesn't just come up to them and tell them that. And it's the same today. Like God's, like Satan doesn't tempt us today by just saying, hey, you should go do this really stupid thing that will ruin your life. Like nobody, that's not how it works. He gets us on this path first. And he gets us to the place where we feel like there's no other choice but to make that really bad choice. And the path starts right here by him saying, hey, you know, you're not good enough, right? Like, you know, to be human is to be worthless. And you know, God's holding out on you, right? You know how inadequate you are, right? That's where the path starts. The conversation in your head starts way before you actually make the bad choice. And this is where it starts. And here, what he does is he says, you're inadequate, you're nothing, and here's some fruit, and that will help you feel better about that. Okay, that is what Satan does. And the crazy thing is, when we believe, like at least personally, this is the last thing I'll say, I know that in my life, when I've believed that I'm just a worthless sinner, I actually probably sin more in those times, looking back on it, because I reinforce that belief with what I do. But when I believe, when I've believed at times that I'm a beloved child of God who has to battle against sin in this world for a while, that actually helps me overcome sin, and it helps me sin less. And so the belief that you're worthless, we'll take this away from today. The belief that you're worthless is a barrier to real freedom. Okay? So none of that allowed, right? Not in this church. We're not going to believe that we're worthless sinners. We're going to believe, yes, we sin. We're sinners. We need God's help. But we're not worthless. Okay? Every single person in this room has value because you are created by God and loved by God and made in his image. Let me pray real quick, Joel, and then we'll have some conversation about this. Okay. Father, thank you for this day.